was there, and I'm about to be that someone. I need clothes. Yes, indeed. I sprint through Beatlemania into the long hallway that bisects the second floor, down the west staircase to the first floor, grateful to be in the pre-motion detector era. The great elephants loom menacingly over me in the moonlight, and I wave to them on my way to the little gift shop to the right of the main entrance. I circle the wares and find a few promising items, an ornamental letter opener, a metal bookmark with the field's insignia, and two t-shirts that feature dinosaurs. The locks on the cases are a joke. I pop them with a bobby pin I find next to the cash register and help myself. Okay, back up the stairs to the third floor. This is the field's attic, where the labs are. The staff have their offices up here. I scan the names on the doors, but none of them suggests anything to me. Finally, I select at random and slide my bookmark along the lock until the catch pushes back, and I'm in. The occupant of this office is one V.M. Williamson, and he's a very untidy guy. The room is dense with papers and coffee cups, and cigarettes overflow from ashtrays. There's a partially articulated snake skeleton on his desk. I quickly case the joint for clothes and come up with nothing. The next office belongs to a woman, J.F. Bentley. On the third try, I get lucky. D.W. Fitch has an entire suit hung neatly on his coat rack, and it pretty much fits me, though it's a bit short in the arms and legs and wide in the lapels. I wear one of the dinosaur t-shirts under the jacket. No shoes, but I'm decent. D.W. also keeps an unopened package of Oreo cookies in his desk, bless him. I appropriate them and leave, closing the door carefully behind me. Where was I when I saw me? I close my eyes and fatigue takes me bodily, caressing me with her sleepy fingers. I'm almost out on my feet, but I catch myself, and it comes to me. A man in silhouette walking toward me, backlit by the museum's front doors. I need to get back to the Great Hall. When I get there, all is quiet and still. I walk across the middle of the floor, trying to replicate the view of the doors, and then I seat myself near the coat room, so as to enter stage left. I can hear blood rushing in my head, the air conditioning system humming, cars whooshing by on Lakeshore Drive. I eat 10 Oreos, slowly, gently prying each one apart, scraping the filling out with my front teeth, nibbling the chocolate halves to make them last. I have no idea what time it is or how long I have to wait. I'm mostly sober now and reasonably alert. Time passes. Nothing happens. At last, I hear a soft thud, a gasp. Silence. I wait. I stand up silently and pad into the hall, walking slowly through the light that slants across the marble floor. I stand in the center of the doors and call out, not loud, "Henry." Nothing. Good boy, wary and silent. I try again. "It's okay, Henry. I'm your guide. I'm here to show you around. It's a special tour. Don't be afraid, Henry." I hear a slight, oh-so-faint noise. "I brought you a t-shirt, Henry, so you won't get cold while we look at the exhibits." I can make him out now, standing at the edge of the darkness. "Here. Catch." I throw it to him, and the shirt disappears, and then he steps into the light. The t-shirt comes down to his knees. Me at 5. Dark, spiky hair. Moon pale with brown, almost Slavic eyes. Wiry. Coltish. At 5, I'm happy. Cushioned in normality in the arms of my parents. Everything changed. Starting now. I walk forward slowly, bend toward him, speak softly. "Hello. I'm glad to see you, Henry. Thank you for coming tonight." "Where am I? Who are you?" His voice is small and high, and echoes a little off the cold stone. "You're in the Field Museum. I've been sent here to show you some things you can't see during the day. My name is also Henry." Isn't that funny? He nods. Would you like some cookies? I always like to eat cookies when I look around museums. It makes it more multi-sensory. I offer him the package of Oreos. He hesitates, unsure if it's all right. Hungry, but unsure how many he can take without being rude. Take as many as you want. I've already eaten 10, so you have some catching up to do. He takes 3. Is there anything you'd like to see first? He shakes his head. Tell you what. Let's go up to the 3rd floor. That's where they keep all the stuff that isn't on display. Okay? Okay. We walk through darkness, up the stairs. He isn't moving very fast, so I climb slowly with him. Where's Mom? She's at home, sleeping. This is a special tour, only for you, because it's your birthday. Besides, grown-ups don't do this sort of thing. Aren't you a grown-up? I'm an extremely unusual grown-up. My job is to have adventures. So naturally, when I heard that you wanted to come back to the Field Museum right away, I jumped at the chance to show you around. But how did I get here? He stops at the top of the stairs and looks at me with total confusion. Well, that's a secret. If I tell you, you have to swear not to say anything to anyone. Why? Because they wouldn't believe you. You can tell Mom or Kimmy if you want, but that's it. Okay? Okay. I kneel in front of him, my innocent self. Look him in the eyes. Cross your heart and hope to die? Uh-huh. Okay. Here's how it is. You time-traveled. You were in your bedroom, and all of a sudden, poof, you're here. And it's a little earlier in the evening, so we have plenty of time to look at everything before you have to go home. He is silent and quizzical. Does that make sense? But why? Well, I haven't figured that out yet. I'll let you know when I do. In the meantime, we should be moving along. Cookie? He takes one and we walk slowly down the corridor. I decide to experiment. Let's try this one. I slide the bookmark along a door marked 306 and open it. When I flick on the lights, there are pumpkin-sized rocks all over the floor, whole and halved, craggy on the outside and streaked with veins of metal inside. Ooh, look, Henry. Meteorites. What's meteorites? Rocks that fall from outer space. He looks at me as though I'm from outer space. Shall we try another door? He nods. I close the meteorite room and try the door across the corridor. This room is full of birds. Birds in simulated flight, birds perched eternally on branches, bird heads, bird skins. I open one of the hundreds of drawers. It contains a dozen glass tubes, each holding a tiny golden-black bird with its name wrapped around a foot. Henry's eyes are the size of saucers. Do you want to touch one? Uh-huh. I remove the cotton wadding from the mouth of a tube and shake a goldfinch onto my palm. It remains tube-shaped. Henry strokes its small head lovingly. It's sleeping? More or less. He looks at me sharply, distrusting my equivocation. I insert the finch gently back into the tube, replace the cotton, replace the tube, shut the drawer. I am so tired. Even the word sleep is a lure, a seduction. I lead the way out into the hall, and suddenly I recollect what it was I loved about this night when I was little. Hey, Henry, let's go to the library. He shrugs. I walk quickly now, and he runs to keep up. The library is on the 3rd floor at the east end of the building. When we get there, I stand for a minute, contemplating the locks. Henry looks at me as though to say, well, that's that. I feel in my pockets and find the letter opener. I wiggle the wooden handle off, and lo, there's a nice long thin metal prong in there. I stick one half of it into the lock and feel around. I can hear the tumbler springing, and when I'm all the way back, I stick in the other half, use my bookmark on the other lock, and presto, open sesame. At last, my companion is suitably impressed. How'd you do that? It's not that hard. I'll teach you another time. Entrez. I hold open the door and he walks in. I flip on the lights, and the reading room springs into being. Heavy wooden tables and chairs, maroon carpet, forbidding enormous reference desk. The Field Museum's library is not designed to appeal to 5-year-olds. It's a closed Stax library used by scientists and scholars. There are bookcases lining the room, but they hold mostly leather-bound Victorian science periodicals. The book I'm after is in a huge glass and oak case by itself in the center of the room. I spring the lock with my bobby pin and open the glass door. Really, the field ought to get more serious about security. I don't feel too terrible about doing this. After all, I'm a bona fide librarian. I do show and tells at the Newbery all the time. I walk behind the reference desk and find a piece of felt and some support pads and lay them out on the nearest table. Then I close and carefully lift the book out of its case and onto the felt. I pull out a chair. Here, stand on this so you can see better. He climbs up and I open the book. It's Audubon's Birds of America, the deluxe, wonderful double elephant folio that's almost as tall as my young self. This copy is the finest in existence, and I've spent many rainy afternoons admiring it. I open it to the first plate, and Henry smiles and looks at me. Common loon, he reads. It looks like a duck. Yeah, it does. I bet I can guess your favorite bird. He shakes his head and smiles. What do you bet? He looks down at himself in the T-Rex t-shirt and shrugs. I know the feeling. How about this? If I guess, you get to eat a cookie. And if I can't guess, you get to eat a cookie. He thinks it over and decides this would be a safe bet. I open the book to Flamingo. Henry laughs. Am I right?
Yes!
It's easy to be omniscient when you've done it all before. Okay, here's your cookie. And I get one for being right. But we have to save them till we're done looking at the book. We wouldn't want to get crumbs all over the bluebirds, right?
Right.
He sets the Oreo on the arm of the chair, and we begin again at the beginning, and page slowly through the birds, so much more alive than the real thing in glass tubes down the hall. Here's a great blue heron. He's really big, bigger than a flamingo. Have you ever seen a hummingbird?
I saw some today.
Here in the museum?
Uh-huh.
Wait till you see one outside. They're like tiny helicopters. Their wings go so fast you just see a blur. Turning each page is like making a bed. An enormous expanse of paper slowly rises up and over. Henry stands attentively, waits each time for the new wonder, emits small noises of pleasure for each sandhill crane, American coot, great auk, pileated woodpecker. When we come to the last plate, snow bunting, he leans down and touches the page, delicately stroking the engraving. I look at him, look at the book. Remember, this book, this moment, the first book I loved. Remember wanting to crawl into it and sleep. You tired?
Uh-huh.
Should we go?
Okay.
I close Birds of America, return it to its glass home, open it to Flamingo, shut the case, lock it. Henry jumps off the chair and eats his Oreo. I return the felt to the desk and push the chair in. Henry turns out the light, and we leave the library. We wander, chattering amiably of things that fly and things that slither and eating our Oreos. Henry tells me about Mom and Dad and Mrs. Kim, who is teaching him to make lasagna, and Brenda, whom I had forgotten about, my best pal when I was little until her family moved to Tampa, Florida, about 3 months from now. We're standing in front of Bushman,
the legendary silverback gorilla, whose stuffed magnificence glowers at us from his little marble stand in a first-floor hallway, when Henry cries out and staggers forward, reaching urgently for me, and I grab him, and he's gone. The T-shirt is warm, empty cloth in my hands. I sigh, and walk upstairs to ponder the mummies for a while by myself. My young self will be home now, climbing into bed. I remember. I remember. I woke up in the morning and it was all a wonderful dream. Mom laughed and said that time travel sounded fun, and she wanted to try it too. That was the first time. First date, 2. Friday, September 23rd, 1977. Henry is 36, Claire is 6. I'm in the meadow, waiting. I wait slightly outside the clearing, naked, because the clothes Claire keeps for me in a box under a stone aren't there. The box isn't there either, so I'm thankful that the afternoon is fine early September, perhaps in some unidentified year. I hunker down in the tall grass. I consider. The fact that there is no box full of clothes means that I've arrived in a time before Claire and I have met. Perhaps Claire isn't even born yet. This has happened before, and it's a pain. I miss Claire, and I spend the time hiding naked in the meadow, not daring to show myself in the neighborhood of Claire's family. I think longingly of the apple trees at the western edge of the meadow. At this time of year, there ought to be apples, small and sour and munched by deer, but edible. I hear the screen door slam and I peer above the grass. A child is running, pell-mell, and as it comes down the path through the waving grass, my heart twists, and Claire bursts into the clearing. She's very young. She's oblivious. She is alone. She's still wearing her school uniform, a hunter green jumper with a white blouse and knee socks with penny loafers, and she's carrying a Marshall Field shopping bag and a beach towel. Claire spreads the towel on the ground and dumps out the contents of the bag. Every imaginable kind of writing implement. Old ballpoint pens, little stubby pencils from the library, crayons, smelly magic markers, a fountain pen. She also has a bunch of her dad's office stationery. She arranges the implements and gives the stack of paper a smart shake and then proceeds to try each pen and pencil in turn, making careful lines and swirls, humming to herself. After listening carefully for a while, I identify her humming as the theme song of the Dick Van Dyke Show. I hesitate. Claire is content, absorbed. She must be about 6. If it's September, she's probably just entered first grade. She's obviously not waiting for me. I'm a stranger. And I'm sure that the first thing you learn in first grade is not to have any truck with strangers who show up naked in your favorite secret spot and know your name and tell you not to tell your mom and dad. I wonder if today is the day we're supposed to meet for the first time or if it's some other day. Maybe I should be very silent, and either Claire will go away and I can go munch up those apples and steal some laundry, or I'll revert to my regularly scheduled programming. I snap from my reverie to find Claire staring straight at me. I realize too late that I've been humming along with her. "Who's there?" Claire hisses. She looks like a really pissed off goose, all neck and legs. I'm thinking fast. "Greetings, Earthling," I intone kindly.
"Mark, you Nimrod!"
Claire is casting around for something to throw and decides on her shoes, which have heavy, sharp heels. She whips them off and does throw them. I don't think she could see me very well, but she lucks out and one of them catches me in the mouth. My lip starts to bleed.
"Please don't do that."
I don't have anything to staunch the blood, so I press my hand to my mouth and my voice comes out muffled. My jaw hurts.
"Who is it?"
Now Claire is frightened and so am I.
"Henry. It's Henry, Claire. I won't hurt you, and I wish you wouldn't throw anything else at me.
Give me back my shoes. I don't know you. Why are you hiding?"
Claire is glowering at me.
I toss her shoes back into the clearing. She picks them up and stands holding them like pistols. I'm hiding because I lost my clothes and I'm embarrassed. I came a long way and I'm hungry and I don't know anybody and now I'm bleeding. Where did you come from? Why do you know my name? The whole truth and nothing but the truth. I came from the future. I am a time traveler. In the future, we're friends. People only time travel in movies. That's what we want you to believe. Why? If everybody time traveled, it would get too crowded. Like when you went to see your Grandma Abshire last Christmas and you had to go through O'Hare Airport and it was very, very crowded? We time travelers don't want to mess things up for ourselves, so we keep it quiet. Claire chews on this for a minute. Come out. Loan me your beach towel. She picks it up and all the pens and pencils and papers go flying. She throws it at me overhand, and I grab it and turn my back as I stand and wrap it around my waist. It's bright pink and orange with a loud geometric pattern. Exactly the sort of thing you'd want to be wearing when you meet your future wife for the first time. I turn around and walk into the clearing. I sit on the rock with as much dignity as possible. Claire stands as far away from me as she can get and remain in the clearing. She's still clutching her shoes. You're bleeding. Well, yeah, you threw a shoe at me. Oh. Silence. I am trying to look harmless and nice. Nice looms large in Claire's childhood because so many people aren't. You're making fun of me. I would never make fun of you. Why do you think I'm making fun of you? Claire is nothing if not stubborn. Nobody time travels. You're lying. Santa time travels. What? Sure. How do you think he gets all those presents delivered in one night? He just keeps turning back the clock a few hours until he gets down every one of those chimneys. Santa is magic. You're not Santa. Meaning I'm not magic? Jeez Louise, you're a tough customer. I'm not Louise. I know. You're Claire. Claire Ann Abshire. Born May 24th, 1971. Your parents are Philip and Lucille Abshire, and you live with them and your grandma and your brother Mark and your sister Alicia in that big house up there. Just because you know things doesn't mean you're from the future. If you hang around a while, you can watch me disappear. I feel I can count on this, because Claire once told me it was the thing she found most impressive about our first meeting. Silence. Claire shifts her weight from foot to foot and waves away a mosquito. Do you know Santa? Personally? No. I've stopped bleeding, but I must look awful. Hey, Claire, do you happen to have a Band-Aid or some food? Time traveling makes me pretty hungry. She thinks about this. She digs into her jumper pocket and produces a Hershey bar with one bite out of it. She throws it at me. Thank you. I love these. I eat it neatly but very quickly. My blood sugar is low. I put the wrapper in her shopping bag. Claire is delighted. You eat like a dog. I do not. I am deeply offended. I have opposable thumbs, thank you very much. What are opposable thumbs? Do this. I make the okay sign. Claire makes the okay sign. Opposable thumbs mean you can do that. It means you can open jars and tie your shoes and other things animals can't do. Claire is not happy with this. Sister Carmelita says animals don't have souls. Of course animals have souls. Where did she get that idea? She said the Pope says. The Pope's an old meanie. Animals have much nicer souls than we do. They never tell lies or blow anybody up. They eat each other. Well, they have to eat each other. They can't go to Dairy Queen and get a large vanilla cone with sprinkles, can they? This is Claire's favorite thing to eat in the whole wide world. As a child. As an adult, Claire's favorite food is sushi, particularly sushi from Katsu on Peterson Avenue. They could eat grass. So could we, but we don't. We eat hamburgers. Claire sits down at the edge of the clearing. Edda says I shouldn't talk to strangers.
That's good advice.
Silence.
When are you going to disappear?
When I'm good and ready to. Are you bored with me?
Claire rolls her eyes.
What are you working on?
Penmanship?
May I see?
Claire gets up carefully and collects a few pieces of stationery while fixing me with her baleful stare. I lean forward slowly and extend my hand as though she's a Rottweiler, and she quickly shoves the papers at me and retreats. I look at them intently, as though she's just handed me a bunch of Bruce Rogers' original drawings for Centaur, or the Book of Kells or something. She has printed, over and over, large and larger, Claire Anne Absher. All the ascenders and descenders have swirling curlicues, and all the counters have smiley faces in them. It's quite beautiful.
This is lovely.
Claire is pleased, as always when she receives homage for her work.
I can make one for you.
I would like that. But I'm not allowed to take anything with me when I time travel, so maybe you could keep it for me, and I could just enjoy it while I'm here.
Why can't you take anything?
Well, think about it. If we time travelers started to move things around in time, pretty soon the world would be a big mess. Let's say I brought some money with me into the past. I could look up all the winning lottery numbers and football teams and make a ton of money. That doesn't seem very fair, does it? Or if I was really dishonest, I could steal things and bring them to the future where nobody could find me.
You could be a pirate!
Claire seems so pleased with the idea of me as a pirate that she forgets that I am Stranger Danger.
You could bury the money and make a treasure map and dig it up in the future.
This is, in fact, more or less how Claire and I fund our rock and roll lifestyle. As an adult, Claire finds this mildly immoral, although it does give us an edge in the stock market. That's a great idea. But what I really need isn't money. It's clothing. Claire looks at me doubtfully. Does your dad have any clothes he doesn't need? Even a pair of pants would be great. I mean, I like this towel, don't get me wrong. It's just that where I come from, I usually like to wear pants. Philip Absher is a tad shorter than me and about 30 pounds heavier. His pants are comical but comfortable on me.
I don't know.
That's okay, you don't need to get them right now. But if you bring some next time I come, it would be very nice.
Next time?
I find an unused piece of stationery and a pencil. I print in block letters, Thursday, September 29th, 1977, after supper. I hand Claire the paper and she receives it cautiously. My vision is blurring. I can hear Etta calling Claire. It's a secret, Claire, okay?
Why?
Can't tell. I have to go now. It was nice to meet you. Don't take any wooden nickels. I hold out my hand and Claire takes it bravely. As we shake hands, I disappear.
Wednesday, February 9th, 2000. Claire is 28. Henry is 36. It's early, about 6 in the morning, and I'm sleeping the thin, dreamy sleep of 6 in the morning when Henry slams me awake and I realize he's been elsewhere. He materializes practically on top of me and I yell, and we scare the shit out of each other, and then he starts laughing and rolls over, and I roll over and look at him and realize that his mouth is bleeding profusely. I jump up to get a washcloth, and Henry is still smiling when I get back and start daubing at his lip. How'd that happen? You threw a shoe at me. I don't remember ever throwing anything at Henry. Did not. Did too. We just met for the very first time, and as soon as you laid eyes on me, you said, "That's the man I'm going to marry," and you pasted me one. I always said you were an excellent judge of character. Thursday, September 29th, 1977. Claire is 6. Henry is 35.
The calendar on Daddy's desk this morning said the same as the paper the man wrote. Nell was making a soft egg for Alicia, and Etta was yelling at Mark 'cause he didn't do his homework and played frisbee with Steve. I said, Etta, can I have some clothes from the trunks? Meaning the trunks in the attic where we play dress-up, and Etta said, what for? And I said, I want to play dress-up with Megan. And Etta got mad and said it was time to go to school and I could worry about playing when I got home. So I went to school and we did adding and mealworms and language arts and after lunch French and music and religion. I worried all day about pants for the man because he seemed like he really wanted pants. So when I got home, I went to ask Etta again, but she was in town. But Nell let me lick both of the beaters of cake batter, which Etta won't let us because you get salmon. And Mama was writing, and I was going to go away without asking, but she said, what is it, baby? So I asked, and she said I could go look in the Goodwill bags and have anything I wanted. So I went to the laundry room and looked in the Goodwill bags and found three pairs of Daddy's pants, but one had a big cigarette hole. So I took two, and I found a white shirt like Daddy wears to work and a tie with fishes on it and a red sweater. And the yellow bathrobe that Daddy had when I was little, and it smelled like Daddy. I put the clothes in a bag and put the bag in the mudroom closet. When I was coming out of the mudroom, Mark saw me and he said, what are you doing, asshole? And I said, nothing, asshole. And he pulled my hair and I stepped on his foot really hard. And then he started to cry and went to tell. So I went up to my room and played television with Mr. Bear and Jane, where Jane is the movie star and Mr. Bear asks her about how it is being a movie star and she says she really wants to be a veterinarian, but she is so incredibly pretty she has to be a movie star. And Mr. Bear says maybe she could be a veterinarian when she's old. And Etta knocked and said, why are you stepping on Mark? And I said, because Mark pulled my hair for no reason. And Etta said, you two are getting on my nerves, and went away, so that was okay. We ate dinner with just Etta because Daddy and Mama went to a party. It was fried chicken with little peas and chocolate cake, and Mark got the biggest piece, but I didn't say anything because I licked the beaters. So after dinner, I asked Etta if I could go outside, and she said, did I have homework? And I said, spelling and bring leaves for art class, and she said, okay, as long as you come in by dark. So I went and got my blue sweater with the zebras, and I got the bag, and I went out and went to the clearing. But the man wasn't there, and I sat on the rock for a while, and then I thought I'd better get some leaves. So I went back to the garden and found some leaves from Mama's little tree that she told me later was ginkgo. And some leaves from the maple and the oak. So then I went back to the clearing. He still wasn't there. And I thought, well, I guess he just made up that he was coming and he didn't want pants so bad after all. And I thought maybe Ruth was right. 'Cause I told her about the man and she said I was making it up because people don't disappear in real life only on TV. Or maybe it was a dream like when Buster died and I dreamed he was okay and he was in his cage, but I woke up and no Buster and Mama said, dreams are different than real life but important too. And it was getting cold and I thought maybe I should just leave the bag and if the man came he could have his pants. So I was walking back up the path and there was this noise and somebody said, ouch, dang, that hurt. And then I was scared.
I kind of slam into the rock when I appear and scrape my knees. I'm in the clearing and the sun is setting beautifully in a spectacular JMW Turner blowout orange and red over the trees. The clearing is empty except for a shopping bag full of clothes, and I rapidly deduce that Claire has left these, and this is probably a day shortly after our first meeting. Claire is nowhere in sight, and I call her name softly. No response. I dig through the bag of clothes. There's the pair of chinos and the beautiful pair of brown wool trousers, a hideous tie with trout all over it, the Harvard sweater, the Oxford cloth white shirt with ring around the collar and sweat stains under the arms, and the exquisite silk bathrobe with Phillips monogram and a big tear over the pocket. All these clothes are old friends. Except for the tie. And I'm happy to see them.
I don the chinos and the sweater and bless Claire's apparently hereditary good taste and sense. I feel great. Except for the lack of shoes, I'm well equipped for my current location in space-time. Thanks, Claire. You did a great job. I call softly. I'm surprised when she appears at the entrance to the clearing. It's getting dark quickly, and Claire looks tiny and scared in the half-light. Hi. Hi, Claire. Thanks for the clothes. They're perfect. And they'll keep me nice and warm tonight. I have to go in soon. That's okay. It's almost dark. Is it a school night? Uh-huh. What's the date? Thursday, September 29th, 1977. That's very helpful. Thanks. How come you don't know that? Well, I just got here. A few minutes ago, it was Monday, March 27th, 2000. It was a raining morning, and I was making toast. But you wrote it down for me. She takes out a piece of Philip's law office letterhead and holds it out for me. I walk to her and take it, and am interested to see the date written on it in my careful block lettering. I pause and grope for the best way to explain the vagaries of time travel to the small child who is Claire at the moment. It's like this. You know how to use a tape recorder? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you put in a tape and you play it from the beginning to the end, right?
Yeah.
That's how your life is. You get up in the morning, and you eat breakfast, and you brush your teeth, and you go to school, right? You don't get up and suddenly find yourself at school eating lunch with Helen and Ruth, and then all of a sudden you're at home getting dressed, right? Claire giggles. Right? Now, for me, it's different. Because I'm a time traveler, I jump around a lot from one time to another. So, it's like if you started the tape and played it for a while, but then you said, oh, I want to hear that song again. So you played that song, and then you went back to where you left off, but you wound the tape too far ahead, so you rewound it again, but you still got it too far ahead. You see?
Sort of.
Well, it's not the greatest analogy in the world. Basically, sometimes I get lost in time, and I don't know when I am.
What's analogy?
It's when you try to explain something by saying it's like another thing. For example, at the moment I am as snug as a bug in a rug in this nice sweater, and you are as pretty as a picture. And Etta is going to be as mad as a hatter if you don't go in pretty soon.
Are you going to sleep here? You could come to our house. We have a guest room.
Gosh, that's very nice of you. Unfortunately, I'm not allowed to meet your family until 1991. Claire is utterly perplexed. I think part of the problem is that she can't imagine dates beyond the 70s. I remember having the same problem with the 60s when I was her age.
Why not?
It's part of the rules. People who time travel aren't supposed to go around talking to regular people while they visit their times, because we might mess things up. Actually, I don't believe this. Things happen the way they happened, once and only once. I'm not a proponent of splitting universes.
But you talk to me.
You are special. You're brave and smart and good at keeping secrets. Claire is embarrassed.
I told Ruth, but she didn't believe me.
Oh. Well, don't worry about it. Very few people ever believe me either. Especially doctors. Doctors don't believe anything unless you can prove it to them.
I believe you.
Claire is standing about 5 feet away from me. Her small, pale face catches the last orange light from the west. Her hair is pulled back tightly into a ponytail, and she's wearing blue jeans and a dark sweater with zebras running across the chest. Her hands are clenched and she looks fierce and determined. Our daughter, I think, sadly, would have looked like this. Thank you, Claire.
I have to go in now.
Good idea.
Are you coming back?
I consult the list from memory. I'll be back October 16th. It's a Friday. Come here right after school.
Bring that little blue diary Megan gave you for your birthday and a blue ballpoint pen. I repeat the date, looking at Claire to make sure she's remembering.
Au revoir, Claire. Au revoir,
Henry.
Au revoir, Henry.
Already your accent is better than mine. Claire turns and runs up the path, into the arms of her lighted and welcoming house. And I turn to the dark and begin to walk across the meadow. Later in the evening, I chuck the tie in the dumpster behind Dina's fish and fry. Lessons in Survival. Thursday, June 7th, 1973. Henry is 27 and 9. I'm standing across the street from the Art Institute of Chicago on a sunny June day in 1973 in the company of my 9-year-old self. He's traveling from next Wednesday. I have come from 1990. We have a long afternoon and evening to frivol as we will. And so we have come to one of the great art museums of the world for a little lesson in pickpocketing.
Can't we just look at the art? Pleads Henry.
He's nervous. He's never done this before. Nope. You need to know this. How are you going to survive if you can't steal anything?
Begging.
Begging is a drag, and you keep getting carted off by the police. Now, listen. When we get in there, I want you to stay away from me and pretend we don't know each other, but be close enough to watch what I'm doing. If I hand you anything, don't drop it and put it in your pocket as fast as you can. Okay?
I guess. Can we go see St. George?
Sure. We cross Michigan Avenue and walk between students and housewives sunning themselves on the museum steps. Henry pats one of the bronze lions as we go by. I feel moderately bad about this whole thing. On the one hand, I am providing myself with urgently required survival skills. Other lessons in this series include shoplifting, beating people up, picking locks, climbing trees, driving, housebreaking, dumpster diving, and how to use oddball things like Venetian blinds and garbage can lids as weapons. On the other hand, I'm corrupting my poor, innocent little self. I sigh. Somebody's got to do it. It's free day, so the place is swarming with people. We stand in line, move through the entry, and slowly climb the grandiose central staircase. We enter the European galleries and make our way backward from the 17th century Netherlands to 15th century Spain. St. George stands poised, as always, ready to transfix his dragon with his delicate spear while the pink and green princess waits demurely in the middle ground. Myself and I love the yellow-bellied dragon wholeheartedly, and we're always relieved to find that his moment of doom has still not arrived. Henry and I stand before Bernardo Martorell's painting for 5 minutes, and then he turns to me. We have the gallery to ourselves at the moment. It's not so hard, I say. Pay attention. Look for someone who is distracted. Figure out where the wallet is. Most men use either their back pocket or the inside pocket of their suit jacket. With women, you want the purse behind their back. If you're on the street, you can just grab the whole purse, but then you have to be sure you can outrun anybody who might decide to chase you. It's much quieter if you can take it without them noticing.
I saw a movie where they practiced with a suit of clothes with little bells, and if the guy moved the suit while he took the wallet, the bells rang.
Yeah, I remember that movie. You can try that at home. Now, follow me. I lead Henry from the 15th century to the 19th. We arrive suddenly in the midst of French Impressionism. The Art Institute is famous for its Impressionist collection. I can take it or leave it. But as usual, these rooms are jam-packed with people craning for a glimpse of a Le Grand Jatte or a Monet haystack. Henry can't see over the heads of the adults, so the paintings are lost on him, but he's too nervous to look at them anyway. I scan the room. A woman is bending over her toddler as it twists and screams. Must be nap time. I nod at Henry and move toward her. Her purse is a simple clasp and is slung over her shoulder across her back. She's totally focused on getting her child to stop screeching. She's in front of Toulouse-Lautrec's at the Moulin Rouge. I pretend to be looking at it as I walk, bump into her, sending her pitching forward. I catch her arm. I'm so sorry, forgive me. I wasn't looking. Are you all right? It's so crowded in here. My hand is in her purse. She's flustered. She has dark eyes and long hair, large breasts. She's still trying to lose the weight she gained having the kid. I catch her eyes, I find her wallet, still apologizing. The wallet goes up my jacket sleeve. I look her up and down and smile, back away, turn, walk, look over my shoulder. She has picked up her boy and is staring back at me, slightly forlorn. I smile and walk, walk. Henry is following me as I take the stairs down to the junior museum. We rendezvous by the men's toilets. "That was weird," says Henry. "Why'd she look at you like that?" "She's lonely," I euphemize. "Maybe her husband isn't around very much." We cram ourselves into a stall and I open her wallet. Her name is Denise Radke. She lives in Villa Park, Illinois. She is a member of the museum and alumna of Roosevelt University. She is carrying $22 in cash plus change. I show all this to Henry, silently, put the wallet back as it was and hand it to him. We walk out of the stall, out of the men's room, back toward the entrance of the museum. "Give this to the guard. Say you found it on the floor." "Why?" "We don't need it. I was just demonstrating." Henry runs to the guard, an elderly black woman who smiles and gives Henry a sort of half-hug. He comes back slowly and we walk 10 feet apart, with me leading down the long dark corridor which will someday house decorative arts and lead to the as-yet-unthought-of rice wing, but which at the moment is full of posters. I'm looking for easy marks, and just ahead of me is a perfect illustration of the pickpocket's dream. Short, portly, sunburnt. He looks as though he's made a wrong turn from Wrigley Field in his baseball cap and polyester trousers with light blue short-sleeved button-down shirt. He's lecturing his mousy girlfriend on Vincent van Gogh. "So, he cuts his ear off and gives it to his girl." "Hey, how'd you like that for a present, huh? An ear." "So they put him in the loony bin." I have no qualms about this one. He strolls on, braying, blissfully unaware, with his wallet in his left back pocket. He has a large gut but almost no backside, and his wallet is pretty much aching for me to take it. I amble along behind them. Henry has a clear view as I deftly insert my thumb and forefinger into the mark's pocket and liberate the wallet. I drop back, they walk on, I pass the wallet to Henry, and he shoves it into his pants as I walk ahead. I show Henry some other techniques, how to take a wallet from the inside breast pocket of a suit, how to shield your hand from view while it's inside a woman's purse. 6 different ways to distract someone while you take their wallet, how to take a wallet out of a backpack, and how to get someone to inadvertently show you where their money is. He's more relaxed now. He's even starting to enjoy this. Finally, I say, "Okay, now you try." He's instantly petrified. "I can't." "Sure you can. Look around. Find someone." We're standing in the Japanese print room. It's full of old ladies. "Not here." "Okay, where?" He thinks for a minute. "The restaurant?" We walk quietly to the restaurant. I remember this all vividly. I was totally terrified. I look over at myself, and sure enough, his face is white with fear. I'm smiling, because I know it comes next. We stand at the end of the line for the garden restaurant. Henry looks around, thinking. In front of us in line is a very tall, middle-aged man wearing a beautifully cut brown, lightweight suit. It's impossible to see where the wallet is. Henry approaches him, with one of the wallets I've lifted earlier proffered on his outstretched hand. "Sir, is this yours?" says Henry softly. "It was on the floor." "Huh? Oh. No." The man checks his right back pants pocket, finds his wallet safe, leans over Henry to hear him better, takes the wallet from Henry and opens it. "My, you should take this to the security guards. There's quite a bit of cash in here, yes." The man wears thick glasses and peers at Henry through them as he speaks, and Henry reaches around under the man's jacket and steals his wallet. Since Henry is wearing a short-sleeved t-shirt, I walk behind him and he passes the wallet to me. The tall, thin, brown-suited man points at the stairs, explaining to Henry how to turn in the wallet. Henry toddles off in the direction the man has indicated, and I follow, overtake Henry, and lead him right through the museum to the entrance and out, past the guards, onto Michigan Avenue and south until we end up, grinning like fiends, at the Artist's Cafe, where we treat ourselves to milkshakes and French fries with some of our ill-gotten gains. Afterwards, we throw all the wallets in a mailbox, sans cash, and I get us a room at the Palmer House. So? I ask, sitting on the side of the bathtub watching Henry brush his teeth.
Oh, Ott!
Returns Henry with a mouthful of toothpaste. What do you think? He spits.
About what?
Pickpocketing. He looks at me in the mirror.
It's okay.
He turns and looks directly at me.
I did it.
He grins, largely.
You were brilliant.
Yeah.
The grin fades. Henry, I don't like to time travel by myself. It's better with you. Can't you always come with me?
He's standing with his back to me and we look at each other in the mirror.
Poor small self.
At this age, my back is thin, and my shoulder blades stick out like incipient wings. He turns, waiting for an answer. And I know what I have to tell him. Me. I reach out and gently turn him, and bring him to stand by me so we're side by side, heads level, facing the mirror.
Look. We study our reflections, twinned in the ornate gilt Palmer House bathroom splendor. Our hair is the same brown-black, our eyes slant dark and fatigue-ringed identically. We sport exact replicas of each other's ears. I'm taller and more muscular and shave. He's slender and ungainly, and is all knees and elbows. I reach up and pull my hair back from my face, show him the scar from the accident. Unconsciously, he mimics my gesture, touches the same scar on his own forehead.
It's just like mine, says myself, amazed. How did you get it?
The same as you. It is the same. We are the same. A translucent moment. I didn't understand, and then I did, just like that. I watch it happen. I want to be both of us at once. Feel again the feeling of losing the edges of myself, of seeing the admixture of future and present for the first time. But I'm too accustomed. Too comfortable with it. And so I'm left on the outside, remembering the wonder of being 9 and suddenly seeing, knowing, that my friend, guide, brother, was me. Me. Only me. The loneliness of it.
You're me.
When you're older.
But what about the others?
Other time travelers?
He nods.
I don't think there are any. I mean, I've never met any others. A tear gathers at the edge of his left eye. When I was little, I imagined a whole society of time travelers, of which Henry, my teacher, was an emissary, sent to train me for eventual inclusion in this vast camaraderie. I still feel like a castaway, the last member of a once numerous species. It was as though Robinson Crusoe discovered the telltale footprint on the beach and then realized that it was his own. Myself, small as a leaf, thin as water, begins to cry. I hold him, hold me, for a long time. Later, we order hot chocolate from room service and watch Johnny Carson. Henry falls asleep with the light on. As the show ends, I look over at him, and he's gone. Vanished back to my old room in my dad's apartment, standing, sleep-addled, beside my old bed, falling into it gratefully. I turn off the TV and the bedside lamp. 1973 street noises drift in the open window. I want to go home. I lie on the hard hotel bed, desolate, alone. I still don't understand. Sunday, December 10th, 1978. Henry is 15 and 15. I'm in my bedroom with myself. He's here from next March. We're doing what we often do when we have a little privacy. When it's cold out, when both of us are past puberty and haven't quite gotten around to actual girls yet. I think most people would do this if they had the sort of opportunities I have. I mean, I'm not gay or anything. It's late Sunday morning. I can hear the bells ringing at St. Joe's. Dad came home late last night. I think he must have stopped at the Exchequer after the concert. He was so drunk he fell down on the stairs and I had to haul him into the apartment and put him to bed. He coughs and I hear him messing around in the kitchen. My other self seems distracted. He keeps looking at the door. What? I ask him. Nothing, he says. I get up and check the lock. No, he says. He seems to be making a huge effort to speak. Come on, I say. I hear Dad's heavy step right outside my door. Henry, he says, and the knob of the door slowly turns, and I abruptly realize that I have inadvertently unlocked the door, and Henry leaps for it, but it's too late. Dad sticks his head in, and there we are. In flagrante delicto. Oh, he says. His eyes are wide and he looks completely disgusted. Jesus, Henry! He shuts the door and I hear him walking back to his room. I throw myself a reproachful glare as I pull on a pair of jeans and a t-shirt. I walk down the hall to Dad's bedroom. His door is shut. I knock. No answer. I wait. Dad? Silence. I open the door, stand in the doorway. Dad? He's sitting with his back to me on his bed. He continues to sit, and I stand there for a while, but I can't bring myself to walk into the room. Finally, I shut the door, walk back to my own room. That was completely and totally your fault, I tell myself severely. He's wearing jeans, sitting on the chair with his head in his hands. You knew. You knew that was going to happen, and you didn't say a word. Where is your sense of self-preservation? What the hell is wrong with you? What use is it knowing the future if you can't at least protect us from humiliating little scenes? Shut up, Henry croaks. Just shut up. I will not shut up, I say, my voice rising. I mean, all you had to do was say, listen. He looks up at me with resignation. It was like that day at the ice skating rink. Oh. Shit. A couple years ago, I saw a little girl get hit in the head with a hockey puck at Indian Head Park. It was horrible. I found out later that she died in the hospital. And then I started to time travel back to that day over and over. I wanted to warn her mother, and I couldn't. It was like being in the audience in a movie. It was like being a ghost. I would scream, no. Take her home. Don't let her near the ice. Take her away. She's going to get hurt. She's going to die. And I would realize that the words were only in my head. And everything would go on as before. Henry says, you talk about changing the future. But for me, this is the past. And as far as I can tell, there's nothing I can do about it. I mean, I tried. And it was the trying that made it happen. If I hadn't said something, you wouldn't have gotten up. Then why did you say anything? Because I did. You will. Just wait. He shrugs. It's like with Mom. The accident. Immer wieder. Always again, always the same. Free will? He gets up, walks to the window, stands looking out over the Tattinger's backyard. I was just talking about that with a self from 1992. He said something interesting. He said that he thinks there is only free will when you're in time, in the present. He says in the past we can only do what we did, and we can only be there if we were there. But whenever I am, that's my present. Shouldn't I be able to decide? No, apparently not. What did he say about the future? Well, think. You go to the future, you do something, you come back to the present. Then the thing that you did is part of your past. So that's probably inevitable, too. I feel a weird combination of freedom and despair. I'm sweating. He opens the window and cold air floods into the room. But then I'm not responsible for anything I do while I'm not in the present. He smiles. Thank God.